Hello, everybody. This is James Spadola. Thank you so much for checking out the first episode of Elected Officials of America. I had the absolute privilege of sitting down with Delaware's favorite politician, former governor and congressman Mike Castle. Just a disclaimer, Mike Castle was a huge mentor and inspiration to me on my state senate campaign last year. Just so helpful in so many different ways, and I was even more thankful that he was able to put some of the guidance he gave me into this interview. So check it out. You'll see we delve into his background as an elected official, some of the hardships his first campaign experienced, what he would say to a young person who might be disenchanted about the current political nature right now, and of course, his proudest achievements and some of his regrets. So thank you for downloading, and please give us a solid rating on iTunes after. Enjoy. Congressman, thank you so much for being with me here today. Definitely appreciate it. And the gorgeous scenery you're providing is just a bonus on top, so thank you again.
You're welcome.
So if we were to rewind back into the 60s, when you first ran for office, what got you started?
Well, what really got me started was not running for office, but was bumping into Larry Sullivan, who later became the public defender in the state of Delaware. And he had gone to, I think it was Catholic law school, had gone to Georgetown. I didn't really know him, but I'd met him. He stopped me on the street, and he said to me, "How would you like to be vice president of the Young Republicans of Wilmington?" And I said, "Larry, I said, you know, I've never really given a lot of thought to, you know, politics one way or another. You know, I'm practicing law. And, you know, how could I possibly be vice president of the Young Republicans of Wilmington? I'm not even a member." He said, "Well, it's very simple." He said, "I'm the only member." He said, "I'm the president." He said, "If you joined, you can be the vice president." And I joined, others joined, Basil Battaglia, for example, and a variety of others. And we started doing things that were a little bit unusual in the city of Wilmington for a political operation. We, first of all, had singles dances. We were all single at that point. And that produced revenue, actually.
For the party.
Rather successful. For the Young Republicans.
Okay.
We organized sporting events. We had teams in the various metropolitan leagues around the state, and I had a chance to play on some of those. And we then organized events and teams for inner city young people. Which was helpful in terms of getting our, you know, name out and that kind of thing. And at some point, it was said that we were raising more money than was the Republican Party. And they approached all of us and asked us to run for office, which we all did in 1966. I ran for the State House of Representatives against an incumbent and... in a district that was leaned Democratic by registration, and I was able to get elected. And Larry Sullivan and Basil Battaglia ran on a statewide, on a countywide basis, and got elected to row offices on a county level. And you know, and it went from there. I served for 2 years in the State House of Representatives. I remember sitting with Laird Stabler, who'd been elected, Laird Stabler Sr., who'd been elected, and he was, you know, a good mentor for me. Also, that particular year, a lot of Republicans were elected, and a lot of Democrats were defeated, and the Republicans took over the House of Representatives for the first time in a long time. And we elected a freshman Speaker of the House, we were able to help, you know, run committees, et cetera. And I got involved with issues, the rewriting of the you know, the crime code, for example, and various things like that. After doing that for 2 years, I was approached by the powers that be in the Republican Party about running for the state Senate. And again, that would be against an incumbent. It would be a district that was even more Democratic than the district I was already in. And it was a bit of a challenge. As a matter of fact, the fellow I'd be running against was the head of the Joint Finance Committee, a fellow by the name of Russell Dineen. And we used basically the same techniques I used in my first House race. I made it a point to try to knock on every door in the district. I didn't quite make it, but came close, and talked to people. That was advantageous. I had help. Hal Haskell was out helping. Others were helping. We worked very hard, particularly in the minority areas, which have always been difficult for Republicans, to make sure that people knew who I was and what I stood for. And that was very advantageous. We cut down the differences by hundreds of votes in those districts from previous years. We didn't necessarily win them, but we were able to reduce the deficit greatly and make friends that ended up, being friends for many other elections to come. And so I was able to win that election. And then 4 years later, I ran for the state Senate again. Since I was an incumbent at that point and not running against an incumbent, it was an easier race, and I was able to get reelected and serve for 4 more years, and decided after 10 years to return to the practice of law. I had practiced law during all that time, but it's very limited when you're dealing with being in the legislature too. So I went back to the full-time practice of law. By that point, I was a partner in the law firm of Connolly Bovin Lodge, which was at that time the largest law firm in Delaware. Sometime in the next couple of years, I was approached by Carl Schnee, who indicated that he would be interested in starting a partnership, a legal partnership. And I made the decision to leave Connolly Bovin Lodge and to help Carl form Schnee and Castle, which we did. We hired some other lawyers and started our law practice. Then in 1980, I was approached by Pete DuPont, who asked me to run for lieutenant governor. This was his second term. He'd had a Democratic lieutenant governor who was a perfectly good guy, but, it's much easier when you have your own party. And he asked me to run, which I agreed to do, and was fortunate enough to be elected in substantial part because Pete DuPont was a very skillful and talented governor, and obviously it helped to have him above me on the ballot. So I did that for 4 years, the opportunity to run for governor came up in 4 years because Pete couldn't run again. Pete had made it clear that he would support me if I ran, which I did, was fortunate enough to be elected. Did that for 2 terms, for 8 years. And then at that point, I had to make a decision about whether to drop out again and go back to just practicing law or continue on in government and elected office. And I made the decision to continue on. And I ran for the United States Congress and was fortunate enough to get elected and repeated that for 9 terms or 18 years in the House of Representatives of the United States. And it all came to an end when I decided to run for the seat that had been vacated by Joe Biden when he became Vice President of the United States. There was a Republican primary, and I ran against basically an unknown person, but, you know, an individual of some renown in the Republican Party. The very conservative groups, and I was viewed as a moderate Republican, which I've always viewed myself as too, but the very conservative groups in the country came in and spent a significant sum of money in the primary. Now, although I had a substantial lead in the general election, according to all the polls, we didn't pay enough attention, in my judgment, to the primary circumstance and lost that particular race. And that was the end of my time in politics. So I've been back practicing law ever since then.
Did you consider running again?
No. No, I'd not consider running again for a couple of reasons. One is my wife, who's my closest person on this earth, was adamant that she'd had enough of this. That particular primary was nasty, and she just was not interested in going forward with it. And I felt... you know, I'd served my time. I'd done the best job that I could. You know, the party had spoken, for better or for worse, and I did not consider. I've never even remotely considered running again. Once that happened, that was it. I did give some thought to running as a write-in after I lost the primary, but that was in September. And I had, you know, raised money to for the general election, but that was a very short period of time to pull off something like that. So I made a decision not to do that either. Running again has never occurred to me. So
of course, not everybody has held the amount of elected offices that you have, but everyone has experienced a loss or a failure to some extent. How did you manage emotionally with that loss, and how deeply did it upset you, and how did you heal from it?
Well, I didn't really have great emotional problems. I mean, I was unhappy about it. I felt that, you know, the party had selected a person who could not win, and that proved to be true. She was clobbered in the general election. But, you know, I was not morose about it or anything of that nature. I was still in Congress at that point. We went back into session. So I went down and did our session. And as a matter of fact, we were in session through January. I did not look for another job or position at all until that was over. I decided that I just didn't want to get the two mixed up. So I waited until the term ended, which was middle of January or so. Law firms started to approach me, and I spoke to them. You know, a couple of offers were made, and I accepted one of them. And that's that was that step. And people ask me now, do you miss it? It's a pretty simple answer. I miss helping people, which is part of what you do as a member of Congress. I miss my friends in Congress. I miss my staff, who are tremendously helpful in helping other people you know, helping me with the development of the issues or whatever it may be. But I don't miss the conflicts that have arisen to a much greater level in politics today than even when I was there, which is difficult enough, but I don't miss that part of it too much. So there are parts that you miss, and there are parts that you don't miss. And, you know, in a way, you can still help people, and I do that from time to time. So it works out.
You mentioned things being divisive, which I think is probably universally agreed upon. You do think it is worse than when you were in office?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it is. It is much worse, and it you have to be careful in analyzing that, because I don't think we can blame it on any one thing. But one of the factors that enters into it is communications in general, because of the internet, because of the ability of virtually anybody to become a political critic one way or another. There is instant attack on the positions of one political party or the other, or one individually elected person or another. And it just goes on and on. I mean, you know, if you are a Republican, which I was and am, you know, the Democrats would attack me on my votes or whatever it may be. But it has gotten worse now. It's become a little more personalized, and it's very difficult. We've seen this particularly in the presidential elections. You see it now with respect to, President Trump and the attacks on him and his, I think, rather limited methodologies for trying to react to all that. It's very difficult. But it goes well beyond that. It stretches to all kinds of people in public life. I mean, I remember the days of running for the state house, the state senate, and just knocking on doors and talking to people. And, you know, there were very few real attacks at that point. It was just a function of, I can do the job better than the next person could. And I think that was true of a lot of elections at that time. But now it's difficult. And the political parties are equipped with the use of computers and the internet to literally take anything you do and to start issuing their attack pieces, you know, immediately. And that's the way it's done now. And all elected officials at the level of Congress and above, including governors and presidents, you know, run into that at this point. And the media enjoys the heck out of it. It helps them sell whatever their particular media is. I remember my first year in Congress going to a lunch which Sam Donaldson spoke. And Sam Donaldson basically said, look, we know that there are big problems in the Pentagon with overspending or whatever. But he said, it's a much better story, something to the effect of, it was a much better story for us to be able to catch you as members of Congress doing something which is wrong, which we can expose. It's an easier marketable item. And it has a lot of appeal on a local basis. And, you know, that is part of where the media is going at this point. And I think that's true.
With such an atmosphere as it is, with so much anger and divisiveness, it would be very easy for a young person to look at politics and be like, that is not my cup of tea. I'm not getting involved in that, which isn't good for the country, of course. What would your message be to a young person who thinks that way and who doesn't have a lot of resources, but at the same time has a nagging thought in the back of their head that they might want to run for office, but it doesn't seem like it's for them?
Well, at the age of 25, I hadn't even thought about running for office. and it ended up being sort of the professional life that I follow, even though I was a lawyer. And I would tell you it's been very rewarding. I have made many friends. I've been able to do a lot of good, I think, as far as people are concerned, help people with their problems. I think it's been a very fruitful life. So I would tell people, you know, they should be encouraged to do it. But I would also tell them, if they're approaching it from the point of view of an ideological drive in a very polarizing way, and, you know, it's the way their political party is and the way they are, and that's the only way, that's the wrong way to approach it. I mean, I just think that this country needs a greater balance of people talking to one another and getting things done. I see this just reading the news in Congress on a regular basis. It just isn't there right now. I don't see it happening at the White House at this point. And that's the problem. And I believe that, there needs to be a greater effort to do better. I mean, I always said the best political job I ever had was being governor. I had a Democratic state Senate the whole time I was governor. But we worked with them all the time. I mean, we constantly were talking to them. They didn't always agree, but we worked out a compromise to get things done. And we had to work out compromises with the Republican House sometimes, which was also a Democratic House at times. But, you know, that's the way you get things done. I mean, there's some give and take in all of that. And this whole business of, you know, we are absolutely right and we are not listening to the other side is really a problem. And I would hope that good people, good young people would get involved, would develop the opportunity to run for higher office, and hopefully this country will be well served. I will tell you, there's some very good people in the House and the Senate. You might not know that if you just watch television or read blogs or look at things on the internet or whatever, but there's some very good, well-intended people, and some very good, well-intended younger people. But it's a question of reaching out to each other, and there's some of that started in the House. There's a bipartisan group now that started. I think it has about 40 members or so, and they pretty much have agreed that they will vote in sync with each other. Regardless of where parties may be. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that we need in this country. But I would hope that people would not be discouraged. I can understand if they are, but I would hope that they would not be discouraged. I think we'll return at some point to a more balanced approach to government than we seem to have right now.
I remember when we spoke probably around 2 years ago at this point, you said something to me that really, really stuck out to me. You knocked on most of the doors by yourself, as if running for office is not this insurmountable task that requires an army and loads of money. Of course, that never hurts, but could you touch on some of the hardships that, especially before people knew who you were, that your first campaigns experienced?
Well, my first campaign experience, I knew absolutely nothing about raising money. And to this day, I was never a good fundraiser, frankly. I guess the Republican Party had given me some sort of money, not a lot, I'm sure, but something. And I knocked on the door of a gentleman who no longer lives in Delaware, by the way. And he said, he welcomed me, and, I had known him before a little bit. He said, "Mike, come on in." And he wrote out a check to my campaign. And nobody had done this. I hadn't raised a penny myself. And I was a little taken aback. What's going on here? And that was the beginning of that. This is a very difficult problem for people going into office for the first time. Because I started to do well in the polls and everything, people started to support me. But for young people who are running against an incumbent, they really need to have a plan for how they are going to raise money. The party, their party, whichever party it is probably not going to do it for them. If they are wealthy and are can do it themselves, that's fine, but that's rarely the case. But you really need a plan, and that is somebody who will be your treasurer, somebody who will make sure that all that is organized, and you may want a separate fundraiser from your treasurer, as a matter of fact. But it's all organized in terms of what you're going to be doing and how you're going to be doing it. And sometimes, you'll be fortunate. You'll have a party, and somebody else will come to the party and contribute $100, and then say they'd like to have a party for you or whatever it may be. So there are things that can be done, but you can be a self-starter. Now, Delaware is a small state. Our rep districts, senatorial districts, are relatively small. If you're in a place like California, where the state senate seats, I believe, are bigger than congressional seats out there,
wow.
That becomes a very difficult task. But in those parts of the country where you're talking about a limited number of people in a district, you can do it on a shoestring. You can do it with knocking on doors and handing out pamphlets or whatever it may be. I didn't even have pamphlets when I started. I had the old mimeograph process where you typed up something on a sheet of paper and then you ran it off on a machine. I had 1,000 of those. I'd hand those things out. But it can be done. And I did campaign a lot by myself. I didn't mind campaigning by myself. I think people appreciated that. Perhaps that's a little more difficult today. People may be more reluctant to open their doors or whatever. But I did it. But I also had people helping me. And, they would, knock on doors and help in that way. And I try to help our candidates doing that. But I think anybody who's running ought to be thinking about how are they going to have multiple contacts with a particular home where there are voters. And that a personal visit is very important. Perhaps having that person attend something where you're speaking is very important. I believe that getting literature out to them is very important. I remember when Joe Biden ran against Senator Kale Boggs, who was extremely popular and one of the finest public officials anybody's ever known in this state. I was helping others in that year, and like others, I never occurred to me that Kale Boggs was going to lose that election. But I picked up a piece of literature in my district where I was campaigning that was issued on behalf of Joe Biden. And it was all these United States senators who at that point were probably held in higher esteem than they are today saying nice things about Joe Biden. It must have been a dozen of them. And it was in sort of a daily news type, newspaper type folder. It was not even in color, as I recall. But I was impressed by that piece. I still didn't necessarily think he was going to win, but I was very impressed by that piece. And that and other things they did obviously worked in that election and for many, many elections after, in the case of Joe.
What do you think, after looking back on all your times, all your time in public office, what is the biggest life lesson that you learned? Taking 2010 out of it.
Yeah. I would suppose that, the fact that you are an elected official doesn't make you certainly any better than anybody else. The responsibility is to try to help others, and you have to keep that in mind. I mean, when you start scorning people or telling them that their ideas are completely nuts or whatever, not listening to them, I think that's a problem. So I think the will to listen, and then making sure your staff understands that too, is very, very important. I think being open to ideas and suggestions is important. I can tell you that one of my favorite things I ever did when I was in the Congress of the United States were the 50 state coins. And I had initially told the coin collectors who came to see me that I thought the idea didn't make any sense. And they came back and they said, well, look, we want to do this in the order in which the states came into the Union, and Delaware is first. And this actually makes money because it costs four cents to make a quarter. And ultimately, they're sold for 25 cents. So there's a 21 cent float. And that money can be used to run the government instead of having to use tax money. So I started thinking, well, that's a pretty good idea, none of which came out of my head. And I worked with my staff who thought it was a good idea. And I went to see the Secretary of the Treasury and his assistant, who were Rubin and Larry Summers, who were Democrats at the time. And I said, I had this idea. And they said, well, you know, we're a little concerned about it. Let's get a study. And I said, fine. We got a study from an entity called Coopers and Lybrand. And they basically said, yeah, this is a good idea, and it will also make money for the government. Well, we had we got it passed in Congress, a lot of work to get that done, I might add. But we got it done, and I remember when they did the first quarters, which were Delaware quarters, and we were right out here in Caesar Rodney statue and Rodney Square, and with a bunch of school kids and that kind of thing, and the press covered it, and it was, you know, extremely well received. And then it went from states to states, and states could pick, you know, what were going to be on the quarters and that kind of thing. And this has ended up making, I think now, in terms of this, it's called seniorage, the float difference between the cost of making it and the quarters themselves, has made something like $6 billion.
Wow.
Which, you know, is money which has been used in running Treasury, et cetera, and which the, you know, we have not had to pay taxpayers money. And we've done other coin programs since then. And they have also proven to be successful. So there was something that never even occurred to me I would be doing, you know, and I wasn't even a coin collector. And yet I did it. Another project that was important, I thought, was Route 1 in Delaware. It had been talked about for a long time. And when I got elected, I went to the highway folks in the state, and I said, we are going to do this. And, you know, no more talk about it. It's got to get done now. And so we did. We worked on it, and they obviously had to acquire land and acquire a route and everything else. But it was done, and it was... you know, it's been obviously very advantageous. In fact, when you see these things, you always think, geez, why didn't we build an extra lane? But the bottom line is that that's been a successful project. I must tell you that when I became governor, it had not been completed yet when I became governor. And, we really started when I was governor too, but... At the end there, as it was getting ready to be completed, I had state police who would take me from place to place. And they knew about Route 1, and they knew it wasn't open yet, but they knew it was all but open. So they would occasionally take Route 1. It was very nice, and nobody else was on it. But that was a very, very important project. I got involved with welfare reform, and I felt strongly about that. That is that, you know, we should do everything we could to get people off of welfare, to get them educated, to get them jobs. You know, we worked very hard on that. And I worked hard with Tom Eichler, who's one of my cabinet secretaries. And we were able to, you know, get legislation introduced and passed and signed, which essentially mandated that people had to either show that they were trying to get a job or being educated in some way or another if they were on welfare. And this became the model that actually Bill Clinton, when he was president, adopted to a degree. And it's interesting because I was the head of one of the governor's task forces when I was a governor, and Bill Clinton was on it. And he came to a hearing which we had in which we had three or four welfare recipients testify how, you know, because of laws like this, they had been advantaged and given the opportunity to get jobs and to be productive in society, et cetera. As a result, he was very interested in welfare reform. And when I got elected to the House when he was president, and we worked on it and actually presented a couple of bills to him, which he vetoed. Then we essentially sat down and worked together. I say we, a whole bunch of people, worked together on legislation that became welfare reform at a national level too. So that was an achievement in which I have some personal pride, but I'm happy because a lot of people were able to take advantage of their circumstances.
So you've obviously worked with countless public officials. Who is one that you hold in the highest regard?
Well, you know, it's funny. You just sort of do your own thing, and I've never really considered, you know, that I've got to imitate that person, or I hold this person in the highest regard, or that person is a bum, or whatever it may be. I appreciate public officials who care about serving the people they represent, who are honest about exactly what they can do, and are willing to listen and to work with you. I consider them to be, you know, the best public officials in some ways. I mentioned Cale Boggs earlier. He was a wonderful man. I thought a very good senator. John Williams was an extraordinary senator, in a different way. I mean, John Williams was spent a lot of time unveiling corruption at the federal level, and was highly respected for that. You know, I respect people on the other side of the aisle. I mean, obviously, you have to respect what Joe Biden has achieved. You know, as I've indicated, Tom Carper has been a friend over the years, and I think has, you know, been meritable in terms of how he represents the people of Delaware. You know, there are a lot of members of Congress for whom I've had, you know, great respect over the years. I worked with John Tanner, who was a Democrat from Tennessee, on a number of things. Lamar Alexander, with whom I shared a governorship when he was the governor of Tennessee, who's in the Senate now, who's you know, done a very good job there. You know, it's hard for me to really rate presidents. Obviously, President Reagan has given some credit for doing some good things. I thought President Clinton was a, you know, reasonably good president. Even Nixon did some good things, did some god-awful things too. But, you know, if you just look at what he did as a president, he wasn't really that bad. You know, I worry a little bit about our current president and his sort of attitude of trying to deal with the press and his opponents by going after them That's fine during the election process, but I don't think it works particularly well when you're the president of the United States, and hopefully that will change soon. One of my favorite people is John McCain, who was kind enough to actually come to Delaware a couple of times for me after I'd been elected, you know, to help with events, et cetera. But I don't know of anyone who's sacrificed more for their country than John McCain in terms of what he did in the military and his years as a prisoner, and then being a very, I think, open-minded and stalwart senator. So I have a lot of respect for him. But, you know, I could probably make a list of a couple hundred people for whom I have a great deal of respect and from whom I learned or gleaned something that was helpful to me.
My last question for you. Looking back on your time in elected office, what is your biggest regret or what do you view as your biggest shortcoming?
Well, my biggest achievement, for starters, was marrying Jane there when I was in office. Obviously, the regret of not being elected to the Senate stands out. I mean, that was a difficult blow, unexpected, and you know, you make the adjustments, but it just was not a pleasant experience. Mm-hmm. And it's beyond just not winning it. That was a nasty primary. You know, if I had one area I wish we were doing better in Delaware, and you know, I worked on it hard, but perhaps we didn't do all we could do is the education of our young people. I consider that to be absolutely vital, and you know, we can argue about charter schools, and we have more private schools in Delaware than, or at least in Newcastle County, than any other county in the country on a per capita basis. But the bottom line is that we really need to educate the young people of Delaware and of America. And I think that's even more true in the lower income communities and perhaps. In many cases, the lower income includes big groups of minorities, but that is one area that I think this country really needs to focus on. It is difficult. It is made more difficult by the fact that college has become so expensive. That people are either staying away or dropping out. Because of the cost of college. I'm on the board of Delaware State University, a historically black school, which was a land-grant college. And one of the biggest causes for dropouts, not academic, it is the inability after a year or two of college to be able to continue for financial reasons. And you know, that's a tremendous problem in America that I think needs to be addressed. But, you know, whatever we can do to advance education, in my judgment, needs to happen. And, you know, I just think there's been a slippage in education and holistically in this country, and we really need to try to step that back up. It may take financial resources, but it takes commitment from educators. It takes commitments from families and parents. It's just vitally important. I mean, I've had the opportunity to be well educated, and I have seen people who are a lot brighter than I, you know, who are sort of naturally going to be talented in that area. But I've also seen a vast majority of people that I went to schools with, you know, who've gone on to be successful, you know, who weren't necessarily at the genius level, but given the opportunity, were able to be productive, able to be creative, to do good things as far as our country is concerned. And that to me is the area that needs the greatest focus in this country.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, sir.
Sure. Thank you, James.
Well, that's a wrap, everybody. Thank you for listening. Definitely appreciate your support. And please head on over to iTunes and give us that solid recommendation. And stay tuned for next episode, where we will have Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer. Until next time, take care.